Welcome to Foresight Friday Roundup, Foresight Health's podcast series for healthcare revolutionaries. Outcomes matter, customers count, and value rules. Hello again, everyone. This is Dave Berta, news editor at Foresight Health. It is Friday, June 4th. On today's episode of the Roundup, we're going to talk about private equity acquisitions in healthcare. The idea for today's show came from an article in the New Yorker this past week that blamed a private equity acquisition of Hahnemann University Hospital in Philadelphia for the hospital's 2019 closing after being open for nearly 175 years. So today we're going to talk about the New Yorker article, what it said and what it means, a few other private equity deals that happened in healthcare this past week, and what some of the latest research says about the penetration of private equity ownership in the healthcare industry. Doing all that in 20 minutes or less are Dave Johnson, founder and CEO of Foresight Health, and Julie Murchison, partner at Transformation Capital. Hi, Dave. Hi, Julie. How are you guys doing this morning? Dave?
The Cubs and White Sox are both in first place. So I'm wondering when the annual June swoon will start.
Yeah, like night follows day, right? Julie, how are you doing this morning?
Well, it's been sunny and 70 in California, so I can't complain. But I think I'm seeing more masks on the ground than I've seen in a while, and it's starting to make me crazy again.
Yeah, that's too bad. Well, thank you.
You can build up your supply. There you go.
That's gross.
Goodness. All right. Now, before we talk about private equity and healthcare, I did want to get caught up on a few things. Dave, how was your Memorial Day? And did anything replace the Wellington Oakdale Old Glory Marching Society's annual Memorial Day parade?
Our walking group marched downtown and came back along Michigan Avenue. Just like the Wiggums Parade, there were no spectators, but I can report there was a line around the block at the fancy and no longer new Starbucks Brewing Cafe in the old Crate and Barrel building, the one with all the glass windows. And I thought I'd seen crazy before, right? There you go.
A lot more than coffee now, right? Thanks, Dave. Julie, how did your daughter's volleyball tournament go? Any new ribbons or trophies at home?
Well, it was 105 degrees in Sacramento on Monday, so the parents were a sweaty mess. And I expect California to catch fire within days or weeks. But her team played the best of the season, which is amazing. But our talk track in the car on the way home was all about losing gracefully and savoring the wins.
Sportsmanship. Love it.
That's right.
How did that go?
Yeah, that always goes really well, Dave. She's learning.
That's great. Thank you. As for me, my CPAP machine did arrive for my sleep apnea, 100% covered by my HMO. So everything I said last week about health insurance, I take back. Now the tricky part is finding a mask that doesn't blow off my face when you turn the thing on and try to go to sleep. So it's a work in progress.
That's quite a visual, Dave.
Let me tell you. All right, let's talk private equity and healthcare. Dave, the New Yorker piece was a big story this past week. If you would summarize the story and give us your reaction to it.
Well, the story centered on the closing of Hahnemann Hospital in Philadelphia in 2019. And it's a long piece, almost like a short novel. And because of that, it reminds me of the opening line in Leo Tolstoy's Anna Karenina, that happy families are all alike. Every unhappy family is unhappy in its own way. Substitute hospital for family, and we've got a powerful metaphor for the Hahnemann story. Hahnemann was a very unhappy place and unhappy in its own very unique ways. At the time it filed for bankruptcy in September 2019, Hahnemann was Philadelphia's fifth largest hospital and was the primary teaching hospital for Drexel Medical School. It served a largely poor population of patients, two-thirds of whom were Black or Hispanic. And although it had a storied history, Hahnemann had been on a downward spiral for decades before it experienced a chaotic and catastrophic death, which was the focus of the New Yorker story. As evidence of the decades-long decline. Even Tenet, a big for-profit hospital system known for efficient management, couldn't make it work. And when they decided it was no longer possible, they sold Hahnemann and St. Christopher's Hospital Children to American Academic Health System in January 2018. Paladin Healthcare Capital, a private equity firm, controlled American Academic Health System, AAHS. Joel Friedman, Paladin's CEO and founder, is the lead character in the final chapter of Hahnemann's very unhappy ending. Friedman considered himself an expert at hospital turnarounds and had done several, including a very prominent one at Howard in D.C. To say that Friedman was arrogant, egotistical, and overconfident is an understatement of monumental proportions. In his short 20 months of ownership, he went through several management teams and legions of consultants. He browbeat medical staff, insisted that he knew better all the time, gave long-winded haranguing speeches, and poisoned relationships with payers. Sounds a little bit like a recent president we've had. He bought the two hospitals, Hahnemann and St. Chris's, without knowing that Pennsylvania had placed a cap on disproportionate share payments for treating the medically indigent. That was pretty stupid. And it was also clear, reading through the article, that Friedman didn't understand the intricacies of academic medicine. The story also included typical features of many PE takeovers, very aggressive revenue cycle management to optimize cash into the organization, aggressive cost cutting to limit financial losses, taking on high interest loans to fund the acquisition costs and short-term capital improvements. The reason these transactions are called leverage buyouts, after all. They also shielded valuable real estate. Hahnemann sits in downtown Philly, and had the real estate underneath it had become quite valuable. So they shielded that from bankruptcy proceedings. That gave Paladin and Friedman a hedge against a risky takeover of Hahnemann in the first place. So if there's a moral to this sad story, it's that we can expect more Hahnemanns in the future. We have way too much high-cost centralized hospital delivery in the country, and all the hospitals are going to make it. And as they get into trouble, some will turn to private equity as a last hope, just as failing retail chains like JCPenney, Sears, and Kmart did. And as we've found out there, most of these stories usually don't end well.
Julie, what's your read on the New Yorker piece and a few other deals in healthcare last week, namely Quorum selling off Quorum Health Resources to private equity firms and a private equity firm selling back to hospitals in Rhode Island?
Well, I love that you just equated Joel Friedman to Trump. I have to say, in his defense, he has been extraordinarily successful at turning around very challenged hospitals over the years. And I frankly think that Hahnemann's issues were just too severe and had been going on for too long. I mean, their payer mix has always been the biggest problem, with far more Medicare and Medicaid patients than its competitors in the area. And, you know, when you have a hospital like that that has been in significant financial trouble for years, if not over decades, you know, all admissions coming through the ED serving none of the issues really that make money for hospitals and elective surgery and things like that. It's, you know, it's a tough case. I agree with Dave, you know, this is a trend, and it's happening in multiple urban environments and rural environments. And Quorum is one of those stories that's about small hospitals and rural environments mostly. Also, you know, Hahnemann's kind of the Medicare Medicaid story. This is a small rural story. They both share weak and weakening reimbursement streams. And, you know, this story for Quorum goes way far back before this QHR story. So I just want to give a little history lesson here. Quorum is a, you know, roughly 2,000-bed for-profit system that went public in 2016 after spinning out from the hospital giant Community Health Systems. By 2019, Quorum was already struggling and was in discussions with KKR about going private. And by March 2020, when COVID hit, shares of Quorum Health cratered, losing more than half their value, and they were in bankruptcy by April 7th of 2020. This is a very quick unraveling of the system. They came out of bankruptcy in June of 2020, and here we are almost a year later. So what this QHR story is really about is their plan, their bankruptcy plan playing out. They've looked at their lines of business, They're selling, I would assume, a profitable consulting arm, QHR, to raise some capital so that Quorum can reinvest in the core business where they're doubling down. They're doubling down on the hospital business. And you know, PE is going to take over QHR and likely grow it into a large advisory business for selling to a broader set of hospitals. And Quorum's going to take another swat at sustainability. So good business move all around, but you know, Quorum has a long way to go, unfortunately. Rhode Island is the tale of another two safety net hospitals. And this reminds me a lot, Dave, of that Mercy and Friends deal on the south side of Chicago that fell apart during COVID. You know, these two hospitals in Rhode Island are failing for the same reasons Hahnemann is closing. Their infrastructure is old, their reimbursement is skewed towards government programs, and their private equity owners, unfortunately, are not seeing sufficient return to stay in the game. And this PE firm, Leonard Green, is effectively selling its stake in the California-based medical group called Prospect Medical Holdings that owns these hospitals. So it's a more complicated transaction than what the headline would tell you. And the Rhode Island governor is just not having it. He is not letting them off easily. He is making this, you know, a stake in his political career. There's no doubt about that. So this Prospect Medical Holdings, as part of the deal, has to provide financial commitment to these two Rhode Island safety net hospitals that covers operational and capital expenses for the next 5 years. And they also have to furnish a letter of credit, which goes into an escrow to the tune of about $80 million in case Prospect Medical Holdings fails to live up to its end of the bargain. So the governor's really extracted significant financial input to make sure that these two hospitals remain open and sustainable. And Leonard Green, the PE firm, has agreed as part of this transaction, where it's effectively selling something, to contribute about $35 million towards the commitment. So it's sadly, you know, a story made sadder by the misalignment of incentives between these two hospitals that are caring for the underserved and investors who are seeking some return. And unfortunately, again, healthcare is a business and one that needs to optimize for the right thing, and that doesn't always happen.
Got it. Thanks, Julie. Yeah, a lot of strings attached to that Rhode Island situation. Dave, anything to add to Julie's comments, particularly on Quorum in Rhode Island?
Well, there's a string that ties all of these stories together. And what I didn't like about the New Yorker article by Chris Pomorski is that he positioned the story as greedy PE firms taking a toll on poor, vulnerable patients. And at one level, that's absolutely true and tragic. And that carries across into the Quorum and particularly the Rhode Island story. The real tragedy is far more nuanced, and Julie alluded to it. In Philadelphia, they didn't need Hahnemann. The other hospitals in the city absorbed the Hahnemann volume and their residents relatively easily. Philadelphia as a region probably spent more per capita on academic medicine than any other city in the country and has some of the worst health outcomes in the country. So what this real story here is, the tragedy is the massive structural failures of the system to meet patients' actual healthcare needs. I mean, when you kind of look at the people that were using Hahnemann and using the facilities in Rhode Island, these are low-income people, many of color, there is an enormous gap between the services they need and the services the healthcare systems offer. And that just creates an enormous burden on already overwhelmed people. And as COVID demonstrated, that burden falls disproportionately on Black and Brown populations. So the real moral of this story is that more investment in status quo academic medicine and acute facilities won't fix the monumental problem that we need to address chronic disease in this country as much or more than we need to address acute conditions.
Interesting. Thanks, Dave. Now let's do a quick lit review on some of the latest research on private equity and healthcare. Julie, what reports or studies have caught your eye and what are your takeaways?
Well, it's no secret that PE firms have been more active in healthcare over the last decade plus, you know, particularly in lucrative specialties like dermatology, orthopedics, addiction treatment. And for health systems or physician practices that are struggling with flattening reimbursement and volume issues, this influx of cash can be a savior. So I also think that we're seeing PE firms that are starting to realize that cost cutting will come from innovation. So there is investment that comes along with this cash that's not just about financial reengineering. So I, of course, am biased. There is some net positive to all this. But the two reports that caught my eye, the first was in JAMA that released a report in early May about the PE in the hospice industry. And what I thought was interesting about this is the hospice industry has transitioned from mostly not-for-profit to nearly two-thirds for-profit over the last three decades. And that's due mostly to substantial growth in large for-profit hospice chains. And these hospice agencies that are for-profit have been associated with things like higher rates of live discharge, which you don't expect from hospice, lower levels of skilled staffing, and the provision of a narrower range of clinical services than the nonprofits. They're doing less and they're doing what's necessary in the mind of the business. So the for-profits have figured out the recipe. They've optimized for what makes business sense. And this industry of hospice has not traditionally been held to quite the same set of rigorous regulatory standards as I think other parts of the healthcare system. So of course, PE sees opportunity there because it's a relatively easy market to enter. Medicare payments are more stable and the recipe's been created by the for-profit systems already. So I thought that hospice in particular, because of how that's evolved, was pretty interesting. The second one I read was about the MedPAC results and the investigation into private equity's activity in healthcare there. And for those not up on the MedPAC, MedPAC means Medicare Payment Advisory Commission. And Congress asked MedPAC to look at four questions, and I'll share a couple that were interesting. Congress asked MedPAC what business models PE firms use after they invest in or acquire a healthcare provider. And MedPAC effectively cited some fairly typical business strategies to increase revenue, reduce costs, and maximize profitability, and said that everyone does these things, and what PE firms do isn't unique to PE-owned providers necessarily. It's really just business as usual. So that was not a very exciting finding. Congress also asked how PE ownership affects Medicare costs, beneficiaries, and providers, which I thought was a very good question. And MedCap separated its findings by provider type, hospitals where they found lower costs and lower patient satisfaction, nursing homes where findings were mixed, and physician practices where impacts varied significantly. And the basic message is that a lot of things could add to Medicare spending, and PE ownership, you know, could be a factor there, but there's so many other factors. You know, this finding also was really not entirely helpful to those who hate PE and healthcare. So MedPAC, while it was very salacious in the way it seemed to be designed, didn't really end up showing anything significant.
Oh, that's great, Julie. Thank you.
Of course.
All right, Dave, same thing. Any private equity reports or studies touch a nerve with you? And what do they say about what's going to happen the rest of this year and into 2022?
Well, Julie, that, I thought that was a brilliant summary of exactly the right way to look at PE investment. Here's a shocking headline. PE firms are greedy. It's a little like Claude Rains in Casablanca, where he's the police chief, and he's shocked to learn that there's gambling at Rick's Cafe, just as a waiter comes over to hand him his winnings. So I've always looked at PE like nuclear energy. I mean, it has beneficial and detrimental purposes that have everything to do with the underlying business of healthcare. So if, as Julie so deftly articulated, if there are opportunities to improve hospice care, and we know what a catastrophe end-of-life care is in U.S. healthcare, through just better business management, private equity is going to jump all over that and be a real force for positive improvement. And there are lots of areas in healthcare that can benefit from that type of focused investment that generates its return by better outcomes, more value, and so on. On the other hand, if private equity sees benefit in investing in physician practices like emergency medicine, and they can optimize their revenue through surprise billing, they're going to do that too. I mean, it's sort of this amoral force. So, you know, there's a fair amount of hypocrisy in this discussion of private equity, because if you look at the business of healthcare, and they discovered this in the congressional report, the cost per discharge at for-profit hospitals is actually significantly less than it is at not-for-profit hospitals. And not-for-profit hospitals are every bit as greedy as for-profit hospitals in pursuing optimized revenue through revenue cycle management. Sometimes I think the smartest people in healthcare, particularly in the technology side, are in revenue cycle. What a waste of talent that is. So we're not going to change the outcomes and get the outcomes we want until we change the rules. So it all comes down to what you've heard me say a million times before. We're not going to change the way we deliver healthcare until we change the way we pay for it. Julie also kind of alluded to this. I'm of the opinion that we will see more change in medicine and healthcare delivery in the next 10 years than we've seen in the last 100. And that's going to be driven by these just breathtaking advances in technology, virtual care, home care, and so on, that really became apparent during the pandemic. And secondly, and it doesn't get quite as much attention, but these equally breathtaking advances that are taking place in our understanding of genetics and epigenetics and their applicability to treating specific diseases, and maybe more importantly, in preventing disease going forward, this concept of scientific wellness. And that type of investment and that type of advancement combined with more farsighted management that private equity can bring into the space, I think is going to lead to a very interesting and turbulent decade as healthcare sorts itself out. You know, we can't practice medicine the way we did 100 years ago in these, you know, highly centralized, fee-for-service, physician-driven organizations. We need much more decentralized care, consumer-oriented, technologically driven, and then informed by these just breathtaking advances in genetics and epigenetics. So I think it's going to be a very exciting decade, but I'd hate to be a traditional healthcare company trying to cling to the traditional business models, because that's just getting harder to do and probably will be impossible to do by the end of this decade.
Thanks, Dave. Yeah, it's a very scary place to be if you're an incumbent. Julie, anything to add to Dave's comments?
Well, that was a hard act to follow, honestly. I think very simply, we all know we spend too much on healthcare as a country. And we all understand that PE knows how to run a tight ship, right? They understand profitability. So while PE may have spent the last decade, you know, optimizing the business in areas without significant quality metrics or performance expectations, and done a little bit more financial reengineering there, I think the next decade plus, to Dave's point, is where they will see areas of innovation, technical innovation, business model innovation that's starting to crop up, and they will take that and run with it and make a huge difference. And we need that as a system. My concern is PE firms without deep healthcare knowledge and understanding are more apt to do damage to the system. And those firms with deep knowledge and a mission to transform the industry, not that I'm biased, can take the industry in the right direction. So, you know, we have to really understand what kind of money is going in from these firms and what it's really intended to do.
Yeah, very, very interesting distinction there.
Yeah, amen to that, Julie. Really great insights.
Yeah, I do think this is a story that we'll keep on giving for quite a while. All right, now as always on the roundup, let's talk about next week. Julie, what should be on our healthcare radar next week?
Well, I think we've heard from Andy Slavitt that he should be leaving sometime in early June. And I just want to say here to all of our listeners that we should all be grateful that he put the rest of his life on hold for a while to jump back in and attack COVID and put this plan on track. And I think he might have even had to create the plan. But I'm thankful, and thank you, Andy. And I think we'll probably be hearing a little bit about this at some point soon.
Yeah, hear, hear. Dave, what's on top of the healthcare hit parade next week?
Yeah, what's Andy going to do next? We could almost make a board game into that. The Liz Fowler, Biden's new director of the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Innovation, who hasn't exactly gotten off to a roaring start, did an interview in Health Affairs this week and suggested that participation in CMMI's payment models could become mandatory in the future. This could be a meaningful development, particularly if it forces providers to take much more downside risk. So stay tuned to that.
Got it. Thanks, Dave. And thank you, Julie. That is all the time we have for today. If you'd like to learn more about the topics we discussed, please visit our website at foresighthealth.com. You also can find a recording of this podcast and all our podcasts on the Healthcare Now Radio Network, iTunes, Spotify, and other streaming services. Subscribe now and don't miss another segment of the best 20 minutes in healthcare. Thanks for listening. I'm Dave Berta for Foresight Health.